Blog Talk Radio.
Glowing red in a bed of coals, the poet is born. Our story is riddled with challenges and changes, like blows from a blacksmith's hammer, bent and chiseled into shape, if only forging a poet were that easy. Emotional development, relationships, experiences, environment, and genetics all take a hand in molding the poet we are today. So welcome to Double Helix, where we examine the X's and the Y's on a show celebrating the human experience, where your true colors are what ties the room together. Get comfortable, because what you're about to hear is the poetry that we are made of. This is Double Helix on Late Night Poets. I'm Afaziana, and with me I have Pam Ray. Hi, Pam.
Hey, baby. How's it going?
Well, been a bit of a crazy week at work, but today was good, kind of crazy. I had three kindergarten classes visit at the same time, so I was giving tours and reading stories and did a little puppet show, and lots of fun, but you know, also chaos, because we have protesters for absolutely everything right now. Everyone just decides to like take offense to whatever book we have, I've been dealing with people threatening to burn me down with the library because I have, you know, inclusive books. So it's been a little crazy.
Oh, my goodness. You know, and I always say, you know, if there's a book you don't like, don't read it. Because I will say, in all honesty, there are books I won't read. But I certainly never would forbid anybody else to. And I certainly wouldn't threaten to, you know, burn down a library. God.
Right?
That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It's been a little scary. I spent this week, like, giving the police tours of everything so they're prepared. I'm just like, oh, my God. It's giving me anxiety.
Wow. Yeah.
So I have both ends. I have, like, the adorableness and, yay, literacy, and then I have the crazy people. So I got
oh,
a little bit of both
goodness.
Going on.
Wow.
How was
wow.
your
week? Well, well, you know, it's all in all pretty good. I'm dealing with some sinus issues, and but I've been taking medicine for that, which then, of course, dries me up. So then I'm constantly drinking water, and then, you know, I mean, it's just a crazy cycle. But all in all, doing good. I discovered this show today, which it came out in 2008, but it's, you know, but I don't know. Have you ever seen the show Sanctuary? Oh, my gosh. You have to watch it. It is, I don't know where it originated from, like what country or what channel it was originally on, but it's on Freevee. It came out in 2008, and it's about this sanctuary for monsters, you know, but like, you know, like creatures that aren't human, and, you know, some are good and some are bad, but it's like, you know, that's the basic theme, but they also solve mysteries. Like the good monsters, you know, and I use monsters in quotation marks or creatures, whatever you want to call them, non-human entities, they help out. They give them sanctuary from the humans that don't understand them and are trying to hurt them. And then, of course, the bad ones, you know, they're solving mysteries. So it's like detective drama slash supernatural. And I was telling my son today, I'm like, it's like they made this show just for me. And I'm like, I have to tell my friend Faisy about this.
Yes,
I think
it sounds perfect for me.
Oh, it does. Yes, absolutely. I highly recommend checking it out.
All right, I will, because honestly,
awesome.
I will probably binge watch that. I'll just like, it'll be like I sit down and watch the entire thing.
Yes, that yeah, I binge watch everything. I books and shows. If I decide to watch a show, you know, like on a streaming service, I don't watch anything else until the show is done. You know, I don't read
mm-hmm.
another book until the book is done. I mean, yeah, that's just. I guess that's a decent quality to have.
Yeah, focus.
But what a great lineup of poetry and wonderful prompts. Did you want to say a little bit about those?
Yeah. So Neil Gaiman is one of my favorite authors. And so I follow him on social media. And one of his newest projects is he has an audio, I was going to say CD, but it's also available in vinyl and, like, all different kinds of formats. So no matter what way you like to listen to your music, you can get it. And he partnered with this group called the Foreplay String Quartet. So that's a fun name, Foreplay. It is, you know, four people playing string instruments, but...
I like that.
Right? Isn't it clever? So he made this album where it's spoken word poetry that goes along with the music, and it's just gorgeous. I love the music. I love his poetry. I've listened to it probably 6 times at least, all the whole thing together in order, but also little bits. Just, I love it. I tend to, like, really enjoy his voice, though. I love his audiobooks. So if you enjoy Neil Gaiman, this is an opportunity of listening to him some more.
You know, I haven't read a lot of him, but I know you and I have discussed before. I did listen to his mythology on the Norse gods book,
mm-hmm.
and he does have a wonderful reading voice. So, yeah, I would definitely listen to more of his books on audio or from anything where his voice was featured.
Yes. And he does books for all ages. Like, he just did a picture book as well called What You Need to Be Warm. And all of the proceeds for that picture book go towards refugee children. So I read it to my coworkers. I usually read to children, but this particular book has things about, like, for people who don't have warmth, and like are actually like outside in the cold, and we work with a lot of people who don't have homes. So if for those people, sometimes the thing that keeps them warm is a friendly smile, is a being welcomed somewhere. It was about how like kindness can be part of what keeps you warm when you're not warm. And we've had a really rough time where one of our regular patrons passed away, and at the library. And so it's been really emotional, and everyone's really feeling the loss. So I read Neil Gaiman's picture book to them, and everyone was like in tears, and they were just like, this is so beautiful, because it was really inspiring story. It's very simple, but it's like, you know, even when we're at our worst, having someone acknowledge us is great. So anyway, that's my Neil Gaiman rant. Love him. Prompt one was based on his poem/song, Mobius Strip, and it's the quote, I'm old now and I'm young. I'm somewhere on the strip. We all are, walking the sign of infinity into the darkness, and I'm looking for signs of life in my memory, reflected in the mirror. So that was written by Neil Gaiman, and we have a few different responses to that. The first one is by Randy G. Pam, would you read that one for me?
I would be happy to. Alive by Randy G. Heart is still beating and my blood is still flowing. The sun came up today. A gentle breeze is blowing. Got a roof over my head and enough food to eat. Can't really complain, it beats living on the street. I can see and hear, well, not as good as I used to. Still ain't all that bad after what I've been through. Easy to take them for granted when you're young. Amazed I'm still alive after it's all said and done. This winter's been hard, a little harder than most. I managed to stay warm, it's a fact, not a boast. Guess it's not much different from winters past. It's funny how they now seem to roll by so fast. Then before I know it, it'll be summer and too hot. Something else to complain about, as sure as not. The kaleidoscope of life ever changing, so I'm sure. Just taking it day by day, I've managed to endure. Upon self-reflection, and I'll voice this, my anthology, I understand life ain't fair, it's offering no apology. But I remain positive with a strong will to survive, counting all of my blessings and grateful to be alive. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And it felt like that had a really nice cadence to it. There was a nice rhythm as you read it. So I think it was written with... If not an intentional count of syllables, it just worked out really nicely. You can tell when someone reads their work aloud as they write or as they edit it, and I would say that Randy must, because it comes so smoothly that I feel like he's someone who edits like that. When I was first joining AP, I felt my work was kind of choppy, and I asked someone advice, and they said, read it out loud. Always read it out loud, and you'll find your mistakes. And it was true. I really did. And this was very smooth. I like the acknowledgement of, you know, the simple things being really important, having a roof over your head, having enough food to eat. Those may seem like things that are just standard to those of us who are privileged, but not everyone has that. To recognize that even though it's been really hard, there have been good things. I managed to stay warm. It's a fact, not a boast. So that goes so well with the picture book I was just talking about. I wonder if Randy read that as well, looking into Neil Gaiman, because that was the whole thing. It was like how to stay warm in the various both physical and metaphorical ways. And I like that it's a fact, not a boast, because it's not like I stayed warm. It's I was lucky enough to stay warm, and that's, you know, that's what happened. And I like that it points out that, like, summer will be too hot. It's one thing we joke about in my neck of Canada, because we love that we get all the different seasons, but also we're like, so then we complain about all the different seasons. It's like we're never happy with the one we're at. We're always ready for the next one. It's like, it's too cold, I need it to be summer, and then it's summer, and it's like, it's too hot, I need it to be winter. Just like never happy where you are. That's not true. I usually love the weather, but it's just a thing there. Recognizing that we're never quite satisfied with that spot, and I like that there's self-reflection in this. I like that it recognizes that, like, life has challenges, but it's still worth going. And sometimes the little things, like the very first line, "My heart is still beating." That can be an accomplishment. Yesterday was my 6-year anniversary of my craniotomy, so that was my brain surgery. And, you know, I celebrated. I had cake. I got cake for my coworkers. I was like, I'm still alive. So, you know, sometimes the little things shouldn't take it for granted. So thank you, Randy G., for sharing that.
Oh, absolutely. And congratulations. And I think it was an awesome idea that you bought a cake for you and your coworkers. Yeah, you know, if Randy doesn't read out aloud when he writes, I would be very surprised. You know, his rhyme and flow is always spot on. I do like how this poem and its general message speaks to me on the blessings of really appreciating the blessings of life, even when things get difficult. And, you know, it does really acknowledge the fact that, yeah, it may seem difficult, but there's always someone who has it a lot worse. And I, too, like that part. The winter's been hard, a little harder than most. I managed to stay warm. It's a fact, not a boast. You know, just, you know, not bragging, but, you know, just stating the facts. And I like how this is a great write on self-reflection and an understanding of life. I understand life ain't fair. It's offering no apology. But I remain positive with a strong will to survive, counting all my blessings and grateful to be alive. You know, I think no matter what, especially, I mean, if you've got a roof above you, your basic needs are taken care of. Yeah, you know, life might not be all grand and everything you want it to be, but you have to, you know, learn to just pause and count those blessings and be grateful for what you do have. So wonderful write by Randy, and very well done.
Well said. Our next poem to the same prompt is by Tempest 5, and this is called Mobius Strip. 100,000 per day, 35 million each year, 3 billion by age 80, heartbeats, computations of brain, infinity a theory, life's regression, from first heartbeat or breath, another, between walks of life, casually healthy or intentionally death-seeking. I'm so sorry, I sneezed. Okay. Choice or preordination, walks casting a shadow, or crawls in one's own. To whom the argument, God or our reflections, in mirrors ignored. Mobius strips quest nothing more than their infinity symbols. Inanimate they may be. Inanimate they be. Humans, not so. See all black in the beginning, attempting to explain their numerous twists. End poem. Can you start us off, Pam, with the comments?
Oh, Apple. In fact, I was trying desperately to unmute myself, but my phone screen for some reason wouldn't come on, so I could just tap that little button. Yeah, I really like this one. You know, I've seen Tempest 5 more and more, and he seems to have, I don't know if he was he for sure, or they seem to have a very analytical mind. And I like when somebody brings that into poetry. It's quite a bit opposite of the way my mind is. And so I like seeing different ways for poetry and self to be expressed. Very cool bringing in the Mobius strip and with its mathematical, twists and turns and, you know, the infinity theory. And then using it almost as like an extended metaphor leading to where it says, humans not so, see all back in the beginning, attempting to explain their numerous twists. It's almost like the poem in its entirety is saying that it is easier to explain this mathematical, this complex mathematical theory and its twists and turns than it is to explain the twists and turns of the human mind and the human heart. And you know, because when we think of people becoming twisted, we often think of them as becoming almost like dark or evil or turning against other people. I like this all the way through, and besides the end, another part that stands out to me is choice or preordination walks casting a shadow or crawls in one's own. And I like how that speaks on, like, that it asks questions, and it makes you think about how much of our life are we actually in control of, you know, that whole idea of, you know, are you heading towards a destiny that you are, no matter what choices you're going to make, you're eventually going to get there anyways. A wonderful, thought-provoking write, and very well done.
I agree. I was just going to talk about that same spot, the choice of predestination. I like walks casting a shadow, because in the Mobius strip it kind of overlaps itself, right? So are you going back over the things that you have left? Maybe you made a shadow by making a certain choice, and then that kind of becomes preordination. And so it's like, at what point did you make a choice that put you into this loop, or did the loop already exist and make you make the same choice over and over again? Or as you go through the loop, do you make the same choice each time? I like, or crawls in one's own. It's like, are you putting yourself in there, or were you thrown down this slide and you're just going in loop to loops? I also think that the poem, and I could be wrong, to me, looks almost like the shape of the Mobius strip, just based on how many words there are in the lines, like the shape of it, where it's bigger on the ends and kind of like cinches in the middle. I wonder if that was on purpose, making it into the shape of the Mobius strip. That's really cool. I can tell that Tempest both listened to the whole poem, not just read the quote, and knows about the math as well, to use the numbers within this, and yeah, to look at it as that theory. Whereas, honestly, I didn't really know about the Mobius strip. I listened to the poem by Neil Gaiman, and then I was like, this is really cool. I got to look it up. And I looked it up and understood the poem better, so I listened to it again. And then one of my coworkers is like a math genius, and he teaches coding and different like programs for kids. And I said, you need to do this, because in the Neil Gaiman poem, the grandpa is cutting a piece of paper and showing the kid how it, if you do it a certain way, it makes the Mobius strip. And so I was like, you should do it where you do this with the paper, with the kids, and listen to this poem and kind of go over, like, how it means, what it means to do it and using it metaphorically while you actually physically make one. And I think he thought I was kind of crazy to combine the two, but I thought it was me. So, Tempest, you did a great job at this. Thank you. To the same prompt, we have Infinity by Jesna Sajan. And it's your turn to read, Pam, if you would.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. All right. This is Infinity by Jesna Sajan. On the cusp of life infinity, the wings of my young life, chipping, clinging, my elderly signs of wrinkles and aging. My memories of a past life cease to exist, forgotten, as I learn this life lessons, reliving the musings of regrets. For this wasn't what I asked for, but this life has taught me. I asked for a rebirth to learn what went wrong before. My memories of a past life with people I once lived with, they still cling to me like old souls. They cry and I listen again. The pains on my deathbed, when I mused on my scars, people who cheated me, I now know what they did. My karma springed on my life. Unknowingly, I lived its game, unlearning what I learned before. Time to begin new again. I searched for the signs of femininity where I was once a man. Now I search for masculinity when I am now a woman. For I am still unsatisfied and bled the lessons of past regretfulness. For I realize never to regret, so to carry the pains in the next. End poem.
Wow, I really enjoy the direction that Jesna took with this. Using it for reincarnation, I think that's a really great take on the prompt. So you're not just in a loop where you live exactly the same all over again. You're learning from the past life, even if you forget the details of it, to have some of that wisdom carry on with you is interesting. But to have experienced all things, to experience being a man and experience being a woman and develop that knowledge throughout your various lifetimes, I think that's a really cool concept. You know, it talks about karma, which my understanding as an outsider for a lot of religions that have reincarnation is, you know, your karma influences what your next life will be. So if you are a good person, then you will be reincarnated into a better life, perhaps in a life form that has a pleasant life. If you're, you know, evil and do bad things, then you come back as a form that maybe you don't want to. I don't know, like a worm or I don't know exactly how that works, but I think it varies from culture to culture. But it's interesting. I really like the concept of using reincarnation with the Mobius strip.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Me too. Yeah, and I was thinking the same thing about how there are different religions, and I too am an outsider to most of most of them. So, you know, that, but yeah, that the concept of reincarnation has always been fascinating to me. And, you know, like I'm always open-minded to the possibility of anything, you know, and I do think there is that possibility of reincarnation, and that it would be interesting to know, you know, how it works exactly. But of course, if we knew, then we might kind of manipulate or try to at least manipulate the outcomes. But I really like the first person narrative here and how she speaks from a point of view of someone who seems to be at the end of their life, and they're thinking about what their next life is going to be. And they're thinking about their previous lives and wishing that they had learned from them. Like, you know, I mean, and it's great all the way through, but I especially like my memories of a past life with people I once lived with. They still cling to me like old souls. They cry and I listen again. I like how that's the kind of listening that talks about being close to your, you know, the kind of listening you do with your heart. And I also liked, I searched for the signs of femininity when I was once a man. Now I search for masculinity when I am now a woman. And I like that because it's amusing, and yet it's so true, because how oftentimes have any one of us wanted to perhaps better understand the opposite sex? And, you know, you think, well, you know, if I had been a man in my past life, maybe I'd understand them better. Or if I had been a woman in my past life, maybe I'd understand them better. Probably not, but, you know. But still, it's really, really just a wonderful, thoughtful write on the whole concept of reincarnation, karma, and, you know, learning from our own past. So excellent write and very well done. And Daisy, I'm going to just step away. If you don't mind commenting after you read the next one, I'll be right back.
Sure. Thank you. So I really, really enjoyed that. I've already commented on that one, but I will move on to the next one and comment on that first. This is, If It Spins, It Was Spun, by Gary C. Gibson. If it spins, it was spun, for every hard thing had begun. Hard links, soft links, more was to the better. God was good. God is good. God is good. God was good. Isosceles triangles became silky seashells, broken down and weathered, pretenses of past tensors, even while waves signed, inventions abode with conjecture and levers. End poem. So I really liked the way that the rhymes flowed in this, and there's some interesting repetition where it switched directions, especially like in between the two stanzas, where it reversed the lines of God was good and good is God, switching that up. And then my favorite line is, isosceles triangles become silky seashells. Partly because I just love the way that the use of isosceles, which is a word I haven't heard in forever, and the alliteration of silky seashells. Those words go really nicely together. I don't really think of seashells as silky, because usually when I find them, they're broken down and weathered, like it says in the last in the next line. But I imagine they were much smoother when they're fresh in the sea, not washed up on the shore. And I also really liked pretense of past tensors. I feel like he's doing some good wordplay there, putting it in a way that makes you think and also sounds cool at the same time. But that was a brief one, so possibly Pam is not back yet. Let's see.
I am actually back. I am back. Yes, yes. You know, I'm glancing at this, and it wasn't a particularly long poem, but, you know, it did offer up some great food for thought. That first line, "If it spins, it was spun," makes me think, and the title, makes me think of the whole idea of, you know, what is it, for every action, there's a reaction, that basic concept. I thought this was a great spiritual rite. I, too, was really intrigued with the phrase silky seashells. Like you were saying, you know, I imagine that, you know, well, it's like, you know, I don't know about you, but, like, we have freshwater snails, and they kind of get, like, the algae-type stuff that grows on their shells. So if you pick them up, you know, they do have that kind of weird, slimy feel to them. So which I could see as being described as silky. I thought, to me, this almost seemed as if it combined the concepts of science and spirituality to show a sense of balance and reaction. So interesting and clever write and very well done. Are you on mute, Daisy?
I was. Yes, I was.
Oh, okay.
I was just agreeing with you that I thought it was cool that you said it was a mix of the science and the spirituality. I think it is a good mix of those. And he says in the AN that some of the ideas in this poem are from Plato's books, the Timaeus and Euthyphro. I can't pronounce things. I really liked Plato's Republic. That's the only one that I've read by him, but I did really enjoy the philosophy in that. So I can imagine that those ones were interesting too. And really, this reminds me that I should read more Plato. So thank you, Gary, for making me think about that. It's been so long, like in university, which is an embarrassingly long time ago. Someone was asking me today how long I've worked at my library, and I was like, 12 years. And then I'm just like, oh, my God, have I really been here 12 years?
Yeah.
It made me feel really old. I'm like, I've been in this job that long. It feels like 12 years ago I was in high school, but no, because I did 6 years of university after that, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, you're one Plato book ahead of me. I've read Plato's quotes, but I've never actually read any of his books. So, you know, maybe someday. Might have to put that on my to-do list.
I mean, it was homework when I did it, so it was external motivation, but I actually really enjoyed it. But I am a nerd like that, so, you know. Prompt two, the poem didn't actually have a name, the one by Neil Gaiman. It just said the poem first read at January 26, 2011, Sydney Opera House. So I guess he had done it as part of a speech. And the quote from that one is, "Time is a beast that eats and eats, gives nothing back but ash and bones." And the first response to that is by Peter Solway. Would you give that one a read, Pam?
Absolutely. Gluttonous Time by Peter Solway could be an ancient emperor's name, Fat Kronos, his nickname, or some brutal peasant bursting with cask, bladders of remembered wine, liver of morning mass, headache to drown, cursed gluttonous time, vultures, sober undertakers, misdirected strippers, hovering for feast of final end, birthday poet in casket, putrid viewing, granddaddy time without his gas mask on, end poem.
That was excellent. Thank you, Pam, and thank you, Peter. So Kronos is, in Greek mythology, Zeus's dad, who tried to kill him and his siblings. And Kronos is the personification of time. And that makes sense that, you know, we say chronology, and, you know, it shows up quite a bit when it's related to time. Fat Kronos, the big time, is how I see that, the big time. I like that it's back into the Greek myths. And where is it now? Liver of morning mass, the bladders of remembered wine and the liver of morning mass, headaches to drown, cursed gluttonous time. So on the one hand, if you're looking at Greek mythology, there's Dionysus, who was all about the drinking and partying. But if that was Friday night, and then you look at more of a Christian perspective, then at church the next day, you have that little bit of wine, which is supposed to be the blood of Christ. And I think Peter might be commenting that you're getting the hair of the dog, getting rid of the headache of the gluttonous time you had the day before. So it kind of combines the two kind of religious perspectives with some debauchery going on there. And he mentions Bruegel, who I confess, I didn't know who that was. So looking it up, I think he's talking about Peter Bruegel, who is an artist in the Renaissance. He was a painter and a printmaker, and he did landscapes and peasantry scenes, and he says in the poem, some Bruegel peasant. So that makes me think it was as if the person was in one of the Bruegel paintings, and looking at some of his paintings, they often are drinking, it seems like. So that goes with that part of the poem. That makes sense. And Peter writes a lot about art, so I am fairly certain that when he says Bruegel there, he is referring to the artist. Birthday poet in casket. That's interesting. And then granddaddy time without his gas mask on. So granddaddy time makes sense because Kronos was kind of the granddad of a lot of the gods in Greek mythology. So he would be granddaddy time. He ends up, I think, getting killed by his children, by Zeus and his siblings. That's because he was cocky. He didn't think that he could be overthrown. So he's without his gas mask. He thinks he can do it on his own, and then he couldn't. I'm sure that there are more layers to this because Peter is very tricky with the layers, and that's really cool. But that was my initial thoughts. What did you think, Pam?
Yeah, you know, I like that. You have some great observation, because I tell you, Peter's poems definitely, for me at least, are never easy to interpret, but always entertaining and thought-provoking. You know, it's funny because my show next, The Dark Show, I'm doing the show on the Erinyes, or the Furies, who were born when Uranus was castrated by his son Kronos. So I thought, huh, that's really cool. But I like that he throws in the Greek mythology there, and debauchery. Yes, definitely always a fan of poems with debauchery. But I like how this speaks on the whole concept of, you know, no matter how much you claim to be a glutton, or no matter how much you point fingers with your religious ideology and claim other people to be gluttons, not one of us will be as gluttonous as time, for none of us can consume as much as time consumes. And birthday poet in casket. I wonder if Peter's telling us that he just recently had a birthday. You never know. But, yeah, I like the nod to the artist Bruegel, which, you know, like you said, I would guess knowing that his usual references to art. But I was noticing that this artist Bruegel, his name was Peter Bruegel the Elder, and it made me think of earlier today on Facebook, I saw not this artist, but another artist called the Elder from the 14th century who had done a drawing entitled it Wild Woman Riding a Unicorn. And it had this drawing of this woman bedecked in feathers riding on top of a unicorn. And I was like, you know, I would want to be the wild woman riding a unicorn. That just sounds cool. But, you know, I this is quite a brevity for Peter. And I do think he offers up plenty of food for thought. And he takes a look to me anyways at the complex diversity of humanity, you know, anywhere from sober undertakers to misdirected strippers. And, of course, misdirected strippers was a great wordplay with the idea of the different directions that the Mobius strip takes. You know, I like how that the hovering for feast, the final end, it doesn't matter who you are or what your so-called virtues are. We all eventually get to the end. So amazing, right, and very well done.
That was an excellent comment. Thank you, Pam. I like being able to hear other people's thoughts, especially on a poem as complex as Peter's. I know so many artists named Peter. There's this one guy who used to hang out at my library all the time. His name was Peter, and he would just draw all day. And we actually have one of his art pieces on the wall at the library that he just drew some of the staff and the regular patrons, and he drew them at the library, just being at the library, and just what he observed. And we love it. So it's like kind of a cartoon, like a caricature version of us. But we bought it from him.
Cool.
It was,
oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
I really like it. So, I mean, he was a homeless man, and he was so thrilled that we wanted to buy his art. We gave him quite a bit. I can't remember what it was, but it was a lot to have his art, and he was just absolutely thrilled. So I think about that all the time. I look at that art.
Very cool. And that definitely must have meant a lot to him.
To have it appreciated.
Yes.
He was always asking us for paper, and you know, usually I don't hand out a lot of paper, but I always wanted to see his art. Here, have a notebook, have an art book. Yeah. Our next, not our next prompt, our next poem to the same prompt is by Blue Leader One, and it's A Cool Mind Reflecting on Time, Love and Truth. Is time cold? Time is the coldest bitch there is. Time don't give any fucks. Everyone and everything, survivability is zero. Against time, time will level mountains, evaporate the oceans, burn the earth, and snuff out the sun. Even the universe will suffer. The eventual heat death is certain. No heat, no work, no interaction, just random particles zooming through space alone. Time is a slow bomb of cold and useless motion. Even time will freeze. That's when time itself will stop. So, is it time or the cold that is the killer? Or is one an aspect of the other? To me, she is a frozen fire that burned me down. It's over, and I feel colder. Still, the energy will be there. Movement will be there. The only missing piece will be connection. Connection's what's important. Balin, we tore our hearts with jagged truths, and everything we held onto slipped away. End poem.
Great read there, Faisy. Oh my goodness, I love this personification of time. And I really like how he opens with the question, is time cold? Time is the coldest bitch there is. And I like how this poem in general looks at the cold indifference of time, how it's going to do what it wants, it's going to pass, it's going to, you know, keep on going or, you know, manipulate. I guess not even manipulate. It's just basically, it's almost like time is just that the water of the river going over the stone or around the stone, you know, and doesn't expect anything or anyone to do anything other than whatever they're going to do. But the, you know, but it's still going to do its own thing. I really like, so is it time or the cold that is the killer, or is one an aspect of the other? You know, and I really think these are wonderful thought-provoking lines, and, you know, the I like how that brings to my mind the idea that they both kill, you know? I mean, we know from, like, well, you know from personal experience with people in your area that, you know, that those who don't have shelter are, you know, in danger of dying of exposure. And we know that, for, you know, like all the rest of life can be just absolutely comfortable, but eventually time will be your killer. So wonderful lines and very well done. I am curious who Balin is, and I'm hoping you know the answer to that, Faisy. But excellent write and very well done.
I do not know who Balin is. It does say in the AN, these words are for a specific person. They're most definitely not for you, so don't worry about it. So I wonder if it's for that person. Perhaps.
Oh.
They're most definitely not for you.
Balin is the Spanish name for Bethlehem.
Oh.
Where Jesus was born. I don't know if that's what he meant, but, you know. So
maybe.
A nativity scene. It's a word used for a nativity scene. Interesting.
Okay. I'm learning new words. I always like that.
Yes, me too.
I really like this. The line, time is the coldest bitch there is, took me a little bit by surprise, but I like it. You know, it's there's an attitude to that that it's true. Time will get you, and I like don't give any fucks, and it doesn't. Time doesn't care, but it's an enemy for everyone. You know, it's inescapable. Survivability is zero. It's true. Time will eventually get you. And I like that he uses huge things like mountains and oceans to be examples, to talk about like the sun itself eventually will run out of time. Oh my God, there was a little boy today in the kindergarten class that visited my work, and we're looking at some books, and one of them was about a dinosaur, and he said, you know, sometimes I get really sad when I think about dinosaurs. I was like, oh? He's like, do you know they're dead? He's just like, I feel really bad that they're extinct. It's not fair. he's so devastated. Oh, my gosh. It was really sad because he looked so serious and just like, I really worry about that they're dead. And then this other kid goes, well, they would have eaten you anyway.
Both adorable.
I know. But then the first kid goes, well, not all of them were carnivores. Oh, my God. These little six-year-old boys were just absolutely destroying me. They're so emotional and so funny at the same time. It was unbelievable. Anyway, I thought about that when it said, like, the sun will be snuffed out because he would have been like, well, now everyone's extinct. I can just picture his little philosophical face. the heat death is certain. So at first when it said that, I was thinking that it was going to be about being too hot because the sun will go, I think. Actually, I am not a scientist. So off the top of my head, I was thinking the sun will kind of go supernova and burn us before it disappears, and then we'd be cold. But maybe not. So when it said heat death, I was picturing us getting too hot. But to not have heat would be, you know, just as deadly. So then it's talking about the cold, which makes sense with the beginning, too, about it being a cold bitch. But what I really like here is when he's talking about how there'd be no interaction. Even if there's still going to be particles, there's still going to be stuff, but it's not going to interact. And then later it says, the only missing piece will be connection, and connection is what's important. And I think that is a really powerful message. That is what's most important to me about this poem, is recognizing that, you know, it's not just that we're like a bunch of cells here. Our parts are connected to make us a person, and then our as people, we are connected to each other. It is connection that matters. It is that interaction that matters. And so even if our matter is still there afterwards, if there's no connection, then what's the point? That just made this a very deep piece for me. I had to mute, but Pam, would you like to comment?
Oh, didn't I comment? I commented on this one first.
Did you? Okay, I'm sorry. You know, yes. I think you did. All right. I'm in a loop of being confused about things. Okay.
you're riding the Morpheus strip. That's what's not going on.
Oh, there we go. That explains it all. All right, well, if you commented first, that means I read it, which means it's your turn to read.
All right, and this is Time by S. Sharp. Skull unearthed, buried by time, cracked like mine, living filled with dirt, thoughts fine as sand, tough as stone, petrified wood, between hollowed thought, stare out gaping holes, ancestor cranium, unearthed bones, fuse your nasal concha, your orbital span, spin of lost eyes, dust, Lost to Thought, Millions of Years Onward, and Poem.
Ooh, I like this. The petrified wood between hollowed thought is my favorite line there. Because you think about, like, hollowed out trees and the petrified wood, but to have hollowed thoughts and in that hollowness have the petrified wood, and petrified as in it's, you know, it's dead, but also petrified is being afraid, and sometimes there's fear between your thoughts. That's just, that line really caught me, and I kind of have to look at the rest of it again because I got stuck on that line. to stare out the gaping holes. Really cool. And then it uses some really specific terms in terms of, like, the body, the cranium, the nasal concha, the orbital span, those things that when you're looking at the skull, you see the parts of the human that you wouldn't normally notice, right? Because of our skin and flesh and hair. But I've had a lot of time thinking about skulls as someone who's missing a part of mine. It's interesting how many bones there are that are fused there, but the different parts of things. Lost to thought, millions of years onward, and it's like your head might be there, but it's not thinking anymore. And then when it's been gone so long, buried there, then there's nobody left who's thinking about you, because everyone who thought about you has died, and everyone who thought about them has died. If it's millions of years later, then there is no more thought of you. You know, maybe everything that you influenced could be gone by then. Yeah, it would be cool if, like, because of your influence, generations later was still affected by things, if it was in a good way. But most likely, millions of years later, the thoughts of you are gone. So that, like, puts it in perspective, you know, makes me feel small. And I think maybe that's part of the intention here, you know, buried by time. Although when your head is full of dirt, you know, dirty mind, but I don't think it means it like that. Thoughts fine as sand, but tough as stone. So, when I think of sand, I think about how it can, like, fall between your fingers. And so your thoughts are hard to hold on to. They slip away. They fall through the cracks. But tough as stone, they can still be hard-headed and stubborn and be stuck in your thoughts. As much as they run away from you, you can also be kind of in a rut with your thoughts, and they stay solid. The skull might still be intact millions of years later, even when your thoughts are gone. Yeah, I'm kind of going in circles on this, but I think Scott did a fantastic job.
He really did, and it's not a long poem. It is a brevity, but it offers up so much complex layers and different turns that you can take with your thoughts on the direction of the poem, that it is definitely one where you can just, you know, kind of end up talking to yourself about it, because, you know, it definitely deserves more than one read. What I like about this is, you know, it has strong imagery and metaphors throughout. It's definitely an amazing brevity. What the thing is it's almost like it has a duality in nature to it. It's it can be as you were kind of talking about what was the idea that it's a representation of the individual's mind, of the mind that gets lost in thought, or the mind that, you know, perhaps loses insight. It's also a great look at to me, the, you know, seeing through the eyes of history. You know, like, you, I always imagine that one of the things that archaeologists think about when they dig up somebody who, like, you know, like a creature like that died, you know, and like a, you know, like what was their, that final emotion, that final thought, especially if it was a quick death, or even if it wasn't a quick death, you know, and I'm sure it was probably fear or something like that, but, you know, it's intriguing how, you know, you look at these bones and you look, there's bones and there's dust and there's dirt and rocks and all this inanimate stuff, and yet, you know, every one of these, especially the bone, represents what used to be a life, which used to have connected to it some sort of emotion, or you know, natural instinct. And, you know, and especially the idea of, and, you know, also I think on the idea of digging into the bones of our own past and, you know, the skeletons we keep in the closet, or even how right now, like, you know, it's been popular in recent years to, you know, join sites like Ancestry.com and find out where your ancestors are from. You know, there's so much fascination, so much to be learned from history, and that skull dug up from the earth, those bones dug up from the earth are a representation of history. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
I agree. And the bones can tell us a lot, even about really old creatures. I was at a museum this summer, and they could tell you so much of the dinosaur's story just based on, like, the cracks in the bones and the things that had healed. And, like, they ended up being able to track it all over British Columbia because it had this broken toe. And so everywhere where there were footprints that had this certain messed up toe, they knew it was this dinosaur. So they tracked, like, its whole life. It was really cool.
Oh, wow. That is so cool. That is really cool. Oh, by the way, we have a caller. It's Robbie.
We do. Hi, Robbie.
Yes.
Hello. How are you all doing?
Doing great. Yourself?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. I've had a
–
I finally gave myself
the
week off there. Yeah. Yeah, and today I'm officially now on the board of directors. That's the first time in my life I've been on a board of directors for, it's called Good Food Box. I've been with that program for 10 years now, and I'm on the board now. And today when I was at the dinner, I won a magic bullet. So.
Oh,
there
awesome.
You go.
Well, congratulations.
You bet.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Magic bullet is quite literally exactly what I wanted. I kept eyeing that one at the store. And then when I saw it as a draw item, I was like, I'm going for that. And there I go, and I got it. So there you go.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And welcome to Laurent as well. Hello.
Good evening. How are you?
Hey, Laurent.
I'm on a different phone tonight because I don't know where my other phone is. Can you hear me all right?
Yes,
you
sound good.
Yep, definitely.
All right, I feel a little silly. I'd written a poem for tonight and then totally forgot to put it up and then forgot about the program, as a matter of fact, until I saw it. Wait.
Well, did you put it up now? Let me refresh.
No, I haven't put it up yet. I wasn't sure if you had the room for it.
We do. We'll have time. Yep.
All right, just let me know when you want me to put it up, and I will.
Okay. I am going to have, actually you, Lauren, read the one by Ben Hart. If you're in for a long one, it is a long one. And we'll finish off that prompt that we were just doing.
How could I turn down Ben Hart?
Yeah. Actually, before you do, should I ask, did either of you have a comment on Scott's?
Yeah. I read it while I was on hold. And it's not quite Alas Poor Yorick. You know, I knew him well. But there's a little bit of that in there. The dust, you know, the end result of the cranium unearthed, bones fused, your nasal concha, your orbital span, spin of lost eyes, dust. Lost to thought, millions of years onward. Lost to whose thought? The person contemplating the skull. I thought it was a real nice twist.
I got a chance to read it too quickly, and it somehow it reminded me of kind of, I don't know if relativism is quite the word, but just the thought of, you know, when we see something from the past, we don't always have the context, and we don't know if we're looking at something, you know, magnanimous and great, or just the most common thing in the world, right? We just don't know. And like I was saying in chat, it's kind of like semi-related, like an ancestry.com. They're always advertising. Well, they got to pump themselves up to make it look like, oh, it'll be a great thing to do. And, you know, I found out that I was related to, you know, Cleopatra, you know, in my ancient DNA line or whatever. And, yeah, but nine times out of ten, it's like, yeah, there's about 50 Joes in my family. You probably don't find out. You find out a couple of little interesting things here and there. But at Ancestry.ca, they kind of make it look like everybody's related to Cleopatra. So it kind of reminded me in a tangential way of that.
Yes, it said I was related to, I can't remember his name. It was like the third president of the United States. But the description was like awful. It was like the slave driving, whatever. And I was just like, oh, my God.
Do I forget that they could end up finding out that they're related to some awful person. Oh, crap.
Yeah. Not great. Okay, so let's move on to Ben Hart's poem. And, yes, I always love Ben's poem, so I'm excited. And whenever you're ready, Lauren, you can do that.
All right. It's called Don't Stop Singing Now. Welcome to the fifth round. Another blue pugilist down. All of them grew to become something yet, a promise to fight louder. How do you like me now? I get my sadness from my mother. It's her half of me that curls my tongue. Oh, the times I coiled it into a fist, only to learn that, like my hands, it was really only a rose, waiting to open its body to the sun. You remind me of her. When reaching through the shake across these wounds in time, picking the wild flowers that stole the vacuum's breath, delay by a stranger's grave, resurrecting a happier hour as a fuck you to death, screaming until your voice gives out when the moment passes. Give them back, give them back, give them back. I watched you dance in a snow globe through storms of paracetamol, and it felt like the road to heaven was a forest of jellyfish adrift in total darkness, like the only benumbed would make it home. Well, I dove right into winter's bleeding of the skies, but only found that we've traded places, and I had fallen another league inward into another galaxy of dim echoing. You wither me. You wither me. You wither me. I am too much like my father. I am too much like my master. I am atrophy, and I am Midas to a fault, But at least Midas's fault lines were painted gold. Mine are just taking attendance. You know where I wish I was right now? Our old spot by the river, where the sun shied between the reeds. You with your feet in the water and your hair in the breeze. Me dancing on that picnic table to the music of the boats going by. Both smoking reefer. Weaving the Berliner walls around our minds into cotton-candied skies. You said then that tomorrow may be blue or gray, but that one day we'd find our way back there in a changed world and scream our names, see if the past could hear us then. Well, my love, I heard you long before you ever reset my eyes and taught my hands of touch. You called me into this life, out from death's dark night. Don't stop singing now, dear siren on the rock. I walk. My body talks and feels ignored by the streets. I wake from sleep, but not from waking, and breathe in monologue, alone. I dream of thee in fear. That fear itself is quicker on its feet, because you are a dancer. And I leave things unfinished. There's too much pain in the world, man. I can't fight it anymore. Only try to live the time I'm given. Forgive me. I know I said I'd go down fighting, but I owe it to myself for hurting without hope to see if I can fly. This is not goodbye. I think that's what mine would read. When it seems tomorrow isn't coming, I hope somewhere in my words you find a place to go, make a home there where the world cannot follow, and grow old. Please, just don't leave. End poem.
That was a beautiful read, and also an epic poem. Where do I even begin to comment? I really liked when it was talking about screaming until your voice gives out when you are grieving to yell, give them back. That was basically in November for me. I had a really rough November and I was just screaming at the universe, like quite literally just screaming. And it's a little therapeutic to just yell it out at the void. But I liked that it talks about resurrecting a happier hour as a fuck you to death. It's like I am still going to remember the happy times, and you're not going to taint that with the sadness of loss. So I like that, the fuck you to death, but still having your screaming time. You know, there's a time and a place for different kinds of grieving. An image that really struck me was a forest of jellyfish adrift in total darkness. And for that to be the road to heaven, to have to go through being stung and not knowing when it's going to come because you're in total darkness, and just having that, it's a forest of jellyfish, so it's everywhere. There's pain everywhere on the way to heaven. Like only the benumbed would make it home. You have to be numb to survive the path there. That is really tough. And then also the way he talks about the person reminding him of his mother, and the person, and then him himself reminding him of his father, and clearly he had more fond memories of the mother based on the way that this is told. Brings me back to the rose thing, where the tongue and the fist both become roses waiting for it to open to the sun. That was just beautiful. And the Midas part, like the Midas touch that would turn everything to gold, but his are just taking attendance. So many fantastic little pieces in here that called out to me. I could just go on all night. I really, really love this. And it's, you know, it's an emotional piece. It's a thought-provoking piece. And I could read it repeatedly and find more in it each time. Thank you for sharing, Ben. Robbie, would you like to comment?
Yeah, it felt to me like a poem that contemplated both, like, the world within, like, oneself and their identity, and then the world without and what the world without is like, and how those two interrelate, as you were talking about, like, how it, the journey of going to heaven. And at first I thought maybe there was nihilism, but I would have to read the poem a couple of times to really see if nihilism is what he's driving at. Maybe more existentialism, kind of like nihilism is more like, well, there's no point to the universe, you know, and existentialism is more like, it's more wondering about what your place in the universe is. And sometimes there's hints or fairly large portions of like a, almost an existential terror in that, but yeah, like you're saying, like there's so many pieces here that they're like poems unto themselves. And that's one thing I like about the poetry at All Poetry. It's a lot of it. There's a lot more poetry here that's a lot more challenging. And I'm coming across more and more poems like this where, you know, it's really structured, like you have all these separate sections and the separate sections are like, each one of them is like a little story, and each story ties into the bigger narrative. And I love seeing that. It's awesome to see that. Like, sometimes I might come across a poem that I care as much for as others, and it might be in that format, but it's the fact that I'm seeing that format, whereas I don't see it in other sites or other shows so much. And so it's nice. It's a nice format to be exposed to.
I do really enjoy Ben's format, too. You know, he has long poems, but he has them in little digestible pieces. They're broken down into sections, and his lines tend to be pretty short. So even though it's long, it doesn't feel long as I'm reading it. Pam, would you like to comment?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Amazing imagery and metaphors. As always, really intriguing rites to pick apart by Ben. When I saw that part about was a forest of jellyfish, I couldn't help but think of the song Octopus Garden by the Beatles. I thought that is such cool, like almost like surreal imagery to it. But I like how this does speak on the idea of somebody trying to understand the complexity of life and death. Great tidbits all the way through. I like the mention of the part that says about separating ourselves with the Berliner walls, almost as if separating ourselves from another person, or even separating ourselves, like, you know, putting a wall inside yourself or around yourself in order not to have to deal with the emotions and the pain that comes with having to get to know other people. You know, and amazing lines all the way through. Definitely very well done.
I agree. Laurent, you got to read it for us. Would you also like to comment?
Yeah, I commented to Ben that walking within his mind through his words is to me an exaltation of images and memory, sadness and fondness, forgiveness of self, and the other things that keep us sane. I thought the maternal image was very touching. There's a dislocation and a bringing together of events both internally and externally that I thought was very, very well realized. Bravo.
That is a fantastic comment. That was the end of prompt two. So for prompt three, unlike the other ones, it wasn't just a small quote from the poem. It was the entire poem by Neil Gaiman. So I had trouble picking out a specific spot. So this is In Transit by Neil Gaiman, and it was prompt three. To find the many in the one, he sweated under foreign skies to see the stars behind the sun. So space and time were now undone. Reality was undisguised. We found the many in the one. We stare at photographs, but none could show the mind behind the eyes. He saw the stars behind the sun. Not with a sword or knife or gun. A simple picture severed ties. He found the many in the one. Light bends around us, so we run. As gravity reclassifies the stars we saw behind the sun. To see the world beyond the skies, to touch the mind behind the eyes, to find the many in the one. He showed us stars behind the sun. Unfucked, or anyway, retiring. In the awkward sense, retirement will never be an option. The gruff gentleman with the cap who understands what the numbers mean remembers a bicycle ride when he was younger. The smoke of the cigarettes he does not smoke kicks at his lungs, mixing with the buzz of the booze he doesn't ever drink. A convivial pint after the ride into the country gave him such a thirst. And afterwards, they lay on their back in the stubble, staring up at the stars together, all the stars. Countable as the words in a Bible, countable as hairs on his friend's head, all accountable. And that is why they never truly touched. The shadow of prison or disgrace perhaps moving between them like the shadows of an eclipse. And in another life, at another time, to see the stars behind the sun, he takes his photographs, fighting the cloud cover, becoming the thing that happened in precipice. Sorry, in Princip, when he proved that the German was right, that light had weight, half a year after the armistice, a popularizer, but not courting popularity. Somewhere a boy is counting stars. Somewhere a man is photographing light. Somewhere his fingers stroke the stubble on another's cheek. And for a moment, everything is relative. End poem. So that was the prompt, but would anyone like to comment on the prompt itself?
Well, Neil Gaiman's just—he's just amazing. I keep meaning to read *Sandman*, and I was reading—I was starting to read *Neverwhere*. That there's a whole slew of books that I have to get back to reading, and I'll never forget *Krupp and Vandemar*. To me, they're like an evil universe version of the Blues Brothers. Just so. I don't know, it's just so wicked and that. But with the poem itself, it's so cosmic and, again, existential. And it's just so... The thing is, it's like I like when a poem is existential like that, but it isn't... It's just thoughtful. Like, it is interesting to hear poems like that that are on the darker side, but I don't... think I hear quite often of poems that are like that are simply thoughtful. They tend towards the darker side too often, I think, because people get that trapped again in that sort of existential angst. And he uses so many paradoxes sort of here in this poem, and I noticed that is something that seems to have been reflective in the poetry tonight. And it's kind of like the paradoxes of thought, but also the paradoxes of thought process. I can't remember exactly what the poem said, but something about looking Behind the Sun or something like that. So I enjoy when I hear things like that because it's kind of, I love things that don't make sense literally, but there's kind of a metaphysical thing that they're saying that kind of totally makes sense. Do you know what I mean?
I do. But there was a reason logically for the part about the sun, because apparently, from what I've read, this was a tribute to Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, and he used a solar eclipse to prove Einstein's theory of relativity.
Oh, yes, yes, that experiment. I've loved astronomy my whole life. Like, the instant you said that, like, literally the instant, like, ah, I know what she's talking about. Yes, because he was measuring the curvature of the sunlight because like the idea was that if special relativity is correct, then it means that the sunlight will be bent at this angle from the sun, and its mass. And because of the solar eclipse, it blocked enough light that they were able to look at that, is my understanding. So, yeah.
Nice. I really enjoyed that. And I think that he has a good understanding of the science, but really it is meant as metaphorical as well. So it works really great. It has the philosophy and the science. And the metaphor, I'm such a Neil Gaiman fan. I just fangirl over everything that he does. Okay, so that was
why I'm looking at starting to read today. After I get off the show, I was like, okay, I'm going to look for that copy of Neverwhere, or I'm going to get a sample copy on Kindle and then get the full copy after.
Yep. Can't help but do that. Okay, so Robbie, I'm going to get you to read the poem by Brundaban Panda, which is based on the prompt we just read.
Okay. Just open a new tab here. So here we go. Life. Life soul. Living nature. Supreme soul. Living person. Life soul timely faces stages of separation, reunion. Life lives ever within the care of mine, natural mom, liberty or reunion, timely occurs, spiritually I confirm. Life cannot be burnt by fire and time. Kayla, can't kill. Life signs as dazzling star, only goal, liberty that I feel. Like the version, time is beast that eats and eats. Life can't be eaten by time, but time truly body eats. Life soul leads the body. Supreme soul leads heart. Life cannot die, but a body dies in truth absolute. End poem.
Well read.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robbie. Lauren, would you like to comment on the poem?
In a very brevity-like fashion, it speaks, I think, the reincarnation, the life soul, the living nature, the supreme soul, the living person. It ties it all together. And the last line says it for me, life cannot die, but a body dies is truth absolute. So the physical dies, but the life force does not. I liked it.
I really like that interpretation of it. And that's the second poem tonight that used reincarnation to respond to the prompts, which is really interesting to me because as I listened to the album that this is based on, it didn't come to me, but now that I'm reading these poems, I can see the connections. So it's really cool that multiple people took it in that direction. I like that he said life cannot be burnt by fire and time, which is actually the opposite of what some of the other poems said, where they said, time will destroy all life. And I understand both perspectives.
Well, the physical life, certainly, not the immortal life.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the difference here, is this was looking at more the soul, the immortal side of things. So great observations. Thank you. Pam, what did you think?
Yeah, this is a wonderful, thoughtful write that, again, speaks on the idea of reincarnation. And I like how he shows that distinction between the physical life, you know, and the life of the spirit, which continues on. And I did like that part. Life cannot be burned by fire and time. Kala can't kill. Life shines as dazzling star, only gold, liberty that I feel. You know, to feel that kind of freedom of the spirit, I think is a beautiful thing. And wonderful, right, and very well done.
And Robbie, you got to read it for us. Would you also like to comment?
Yes, there's a tension between mortality and immortality here. And it's kind of the tension in the sense of that the material world is mortal, the spiritual world isn't. And in a funny way, I got reminded of, I don't know why, it's an image, it's a thought that was presented to me that really sticks with me. It comes from a bit of a mundane source, or some might say mundane, but in Marvel Comics, I remember seeing a poster for it, and it showed it so graphically. It had this alternate universe called the Cancerverse, and in that universe, death doesn't exist. And, you know, people say, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if death didn't exist, and that in this universe, life just horribly, horribly, horribly overruns everything. It's like the poster made it look like, actually, I kind of remember a Star Trek episode where they had an overpopulation thing and everybody, like the whole planet was literally, like the whole planet had no room. Everybody was bumping into each other all the time. And it's just, you feel like that dread of that kind of thought of like a world or a universe where life overruns so much because none of it ever passes, that you just stuck in this horrendous situation of like where you literally can't move without bumping into somebody. And that's like your whole life, right? And like that, when I saw those two representations of that idea, it stuck with me. It just stuck. So I got reminded of that thought of like the mortal side of things, and with immortal here, I just like the tension that he has between it. Like he going back and forth in the stanzas between, like it says, your life cannot be burnt by fire and time, can't kill. Life shines as dazzling star, only liberty I can feel. This is more what I was looking at. But time is beast that eats and eats. Life can't be eaten by time, but time truly body eats. So it's like the body, life itself, can't be eaten by time. But time, it turns around again. It says time, the passage of time eats away at the body. So he's constantly going back and forth between like the two sides of things.
Well, and that was actually another one of the prompts. So he combined the prompts, because in prompt two, the quote was, time is a beast that eats and eats, gives nothing back but ash and bones, which was in another poem by Neil Gaiman. So it looks like he combined some of the prompts, which is cool. Okay, so the next one I'm putting up is by Pam. Miss Pam, would you please read your poem?
Absolutely. And just to let you know, I didn't have time to write something new. This is a pre-write, not 20 of your prompts, but I kind of figured Like, well, to be honest, it mentions the word time, so I apologize if it's not quite on the spot. But this is Fragments of Time on Electrical Rope, and it goes like this. The spies are all spying. The people are crying. Violence and silence thrown against the wall, and Mary is naught but contrary. Master Canned Ham ran with the flan, looking for signs of some hope. But hope couldn't be, so the lies all came free on the swing of electrical rope. Broken fragments of time in the hand of the mime, shallow prospects of peace, cutthroat coins, blood spilled, and gods never pay for their crimes. Lessons are never learned from the pages all burned, blackballed brainstorming, nocturnal spittle, editing the bullet in the handwriting of a stooge warden. Frigid waters wait for the sun. The warmth of mercy is gone. A canary song kills the cattle. Farmers are crushed to huckleberry mush under the stumbling stones of the bridge. End poem.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing this, Pam. I like how you use some traditional kind of rhymes, like the Mary is not but contrary, because Mary, Mary's quite contrary. There is a rhyme that I know that's connected to. At the end there, too, when you did the canary song, because the canary in a coal mine, the canary warns you when something bad is going to happen, because the canaries would die in the mine if the air wasn't right. Or I can't remember what it is exactly that caused it, but it's if the canary dies, that's a sign that everyone is in danger, right? So good reference there. And it's not like you just said the canary in the coal mine. It's a canary song kills the cattle. You do it very subtly, but it's also clearly there. The farmers are crushed to huckleberry mush. That is both morbid and adorable, the way it's the huckleberry mush. I don't know. I'm like, that's cute but horrible at the same time. Under the stumbling stones of the bridge. And picturing the stones of the bridge and I'm picturing like the Billy Goat's Gruff bridge for some reason. It's just like old school little fairy tale bridge. This has so many fun little pieces, but it's an overall like serious piece at the same time. And it has a little bit of playfulness to the rhymes. The spies are all spying. The people are crying. There's a like upbeat rhythm, and yet it has a dark side. And I like that combination. I think that the fun side of it makes the serious side of it like palatable. So people can enjoy it, but also get your message at the same time.
Thank you very much.
Lauren, what did you think?
Let me get off mute here. As ever, I enjoyed your poetry, especially this one, because I like rhymes, and I like what you did with the rhymes. It stands up, is kind of independent of the others, and yet there is a thread that does connect them. In many ways, it's a cautionary tale, I think, about today. The spies are all spying. The people are crying. Violence and silence thrown against the wall. Broken fragments of time in the hand of the mime. Shallow prospects of peace. All the way through here, there are things that refer to our world, its problems, and yet they all remain independent of each other. The last stanza, frigid waters wait for the sun, the warmth of mercy is gone, especially hit home. I enjoyed Afazian's interpretation of the last two lines, the huckleberry mush. And anytime I think of a small country bridge, I always think about the troll under the bridge. Now, this is really well done. I love the title, Fragments of Time on Electrical Rope. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Excellent comment. Robbie, would you like to comment as well?
Well, there's a couple of things that stood out for me. Well, one of the first things was, and gods never pay for their crime. And it reminded me especially of Greek poetry. I think about, and I'm reading a novel about Medusa, actually. And, you know, like the Greeks, they were like basically the frat boys of the gods. Their amorality is just insane. And I was thinking of actually, again, this is something that would be not exactly what you might think of at first, but I was just remembering one time when I watched Star Trek, The Next Generation, and again, it was something that really stuck with me. They're talking to Worf about the Klingon gods, and he says, "We killed our gods long ago. They were too much trouble." Yeah, that was my reaction. I laughed out loud because I wouldn't say the word absurdity, but just the dark existential humor behind that. So that part there reminded me of that. And I enjoyed the use of the fairy tales because the fairy tales, they're such a curious animal to me because, you know, it's like Brothers Grimm, you know, when you look at it, they are not innocent tales. And a lot of times fairy tales are like that. They're like on the surface, they look like a very whimsical tale or a very light tale. But then, you know, you find out a deeper meaning or when you look at it more carefully and you're like, oh, wow, this is dark. And like, I didn't know for the longest time that the tale of the mermaid, like when she gets her wish and she gets human legs and that every single, I think there's like a punishment involved because of her wish that, you know, how dare she wish that she be on the land. And every single step she took, it felt like she was walking on glass. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, my God, that's just brutal and morbid. And, like, even in the modern age, I don't always hear stories that are that, like, graphic, right? So because of that and because of what the ideas you were trying to convey in this poem, I felt that the use of fairy tales like that was completely on point. And I enjoyed too the Huckleberry Mush. I'm never gonna look at the title Huckleberry Finn and think of it the same way again.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Robbie.
It was really excellent. I am going to now put Lawrence's poem up. There is going to be one carryover, I think, but that's actually, it really fits well with my tomorrow theme. So, S.E. DeHaven, if you are listening, yours is going to be read tomorrow night because it also fits my prompt for that. Okay, whenever you're ready, Laurent.
All right. This is called Mobius Strip Wreathed in Fire and Ice. Night trundles slowly towards hesitant morning. A heavy dew gathers, its surface an emerging sheen of light. Dawn coyly lifts her skirts, showing a little ankle. Rented day owns the noonday sun, loosening the grasp of man, sending him to the tree of his fathers, who laid seed where no seed lay, bringing water to soak a drying earth, affording relief in the shade of their planting. Progenitors live at either end of the candle, flames of diverse height burning towards the child in the middle, triggering backdrafts. We are most alive in the waking dreams of our mothers, who suckled us, warmed and scrubbed us, explained the night as it stole mother's sun, bringing the painted moon. Dog bays at the winter sky. Gray wolf answers, each knowing the other by their certainties, each a servant to their lodging and tribe. Occasionally man howls, beholden to his brethren, walking the madness of a Mobius strip wreathed in fire and ice. End poem.
That was a fantastic poem, and I love your reading voice so much. I love the way you personify the night in the first stanza. Night trundles slowly, and Dawn coyly lifts her skirts, showing a little ankle. I really like that. To use the different times of day kind of works really well, because you're talking about the Mobius strip, which is kind of like that back and forth of time, and we measure time by the sun, and for that to go back and forth. But also when you're talking about sun and then you go into talking about fathers, it makes me think that sun can work in both ways, the S-O-N version of sun as well, connecting with the tree of his fathers. The vocabulary, like progenitors, awesome. Where was the other part I wanted to talk about? Occasionally man howls, beholden to his brethren. I really like that. And then the end, of course, walking in the madness of a Mobius strip wreathed in fire and ice. This is fabulous. I love it. Pam, would you like to comment?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very glad to see that you were inspired, Laurent, and that you called in to join us and read this for us. Brilliant imagery and metaphors. I like how this speaks to me on the idea of the human spirit, the human mind, and, you know, our individuality with all its twists and turns, are compelled by the elements and outside forces around us. Really strong lines all the way through, but I was most drawn to, we are most alive in the waking dreams of our mothers who suckled us, warmed us, and scrubbed us, explain the night as it stole mother's sun, bringing the painted moon. And I like that because it's that idea that we need something, some balancing force in our life that explains away the fears, the things that we do not understand. So amazing write and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
Robbie, we have a couple of minutes left if you would like to comment as well.
Yeah, I perked up right away when I saw that you're using the image of a Mobius strip. And I like the way you wrapped up the poem with the Mobius strip at the end, wreathed in fire and ice, so like two oppositional elements on a Mobius strip. To me, that makes metaphorically like complete sense. And the second last stanza, I got kind of an idea of tension in man with his more beastly and his higher nature, because of how it says that occasionally man howls, and especially when it says beholden to his brethren, so kind of the feeling of, you know, other men are his tribe, and there's like conflict in that tribe. I don't know if I read that wrong or not, but and just overall, the poem had kind of the feeling of what the nature of time and how we perceive it, like with the Dawn coyly lifting up her skirt.
Yeah, we all live at the behest of others in many ways, everything repeating. And we are connected so deeply to the animals, even if we don't know it, that occasionally we join them, whether we want to or not. And if we do so by howling, well, then so be it. But yeah, it's always the same path repeating.
Well done. And that worked really well with prompt one of the contest. So fantastic. I didn't see you in the contest, but you'd definitely be a finalist, so sneak you in there. Tomorrow for Part Sinner, Part Saint, we are also doing quotes by Neil Gaiman for a different poem that he did on the album with Foreplay. And that one is called The Wreckers. So I had a whole bunch of prompts just from that one poem, because that poem in particular was, it just really spoke to me. And we have lots of amazing rights to that one. So tune in to Part Sinner, Part Saint, and the After Midnight show that goes between Friday night and Saturday morning. In half an hour, we're going to have Pam's show. So stay tuned for Pam's. What's your show called tonight, Pam?
Echoes in the Dark, and the topic is the Furies or the Erinyes, the goddesses of vengeance.
Ooh, I love it. All right, thank you so much for calling in, all three of you, and thank you to everyone who wrote for the contest. Good night, everyone.
Good night, all.
Good night, all.